Golf Smarter number 136 for July 22, 2008.
Smarterpodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Course design and strategy with golf course architect Robin Nelson.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week we tap the best minds in golf to help lower your scores with tips, drills, insights, and advice. In conversation with course pros, architects, authors, players, teaching gurus, and coaches, here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter podcast. Today's show is brought to you in part by CaddyTips.com. Get professional caddy advice for your next round at courses in the United States, Scotland, and Ireland. And don't forget, as a Golf Smarter listener, you get a 50% discount. I don't spend a lot of time talking about private golf courses on the show, but have to say that this past weekend, I was invited out to Sonoma Golf Course, which has been the home of the Schwab Cup Championship on the Champions Tour the last few years. Thanks to Jay Shea, a Golf Smarter listener who contacted me and invited me to be his guest. I played the course a few times before it went private a few years back, and I really enjoy that track. It's really beautiful and love playing alongside the wine vineyard. So thanks again, Jay. Hey, I'm sure you watched some of the British Open this past weekend. I bring it up only because of the amazing performance of Greg Norman. Why does that pertain to us? Well, if you remember a few weeks back, we had Don White, the Hall of Fame clubmaker who works for McGregor Golf. He made the clubs that Norman used this past weekend. I spoke to someone over at R&D at McGregor Golf yesterday, and apparently those clubs will be available to the public later this year. So keep your eyes open for the 2009 VIP Pro Diamondback Clubs by McGregor Golf, as designed by Golf Smarter's friend, Don White. Our guest today is Robin Nelson, a respected and prolific golf course architect that has designed and redesigned courses in Australia, Canada, China, France, Guam, Indonesia, Japan, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, and of course, all over the United States, including Hawaii, where he lived for a number of years. I was introduced to Robin recently, and we went out to Stone Tree and played together. We really enjoyed sharing a cart together, talking about a lot of things other than golf. Somewhat reluctantly, he agreed to do an interview with me back in my studio and talk about course design, strategy, the history of golf architecture, and the changes that he's seen since he's graduated with a degree in architecture from Berkeley. You can read more about Robin at his website, which is nelsonhayworth.com. That's Hayworth without the Y, so it's H-A-W-O-R-T-H, nelsonhayworth.com. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. Let's take the perspective of a golfer, because you play golf, and you've got the eye of an architect, because that's what you do. So when you walk onto a golf course for the first time that you've never seen, what do you look at and look for?
That's a good question.
Oh, thank you. This is going to be fun.
I'd say in the first 5 seconds, about 100 different things go through my head.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because there's so many different things. There's so many different aspects about a golf course that you can't summarize and look at and say, oh, I like it.
Right.
I mean, you can get a first impression, like walk in a house and say, oh, this is a nice house. But there's so much to a golf course. I mean, it's a life of its own. So,
do you look at it first as an architect, or do you look at it first as a golfer?
Oh, I look at it first as a golfer.
Really?
Yeah, because that's what I was first. I mean, I love the game of golf. And then I look, you know, I say, oh, yeah, I guess I kind of got to look at this professionally, too. But I come to a golf course to play golf. I mean, I love the game of golf. And there are times when I go to golf courses professionally and just, you know, look at the design for remodeling something, or if I'm learning something, or something new that I haven't seen. But when I play, I'm going to play. And so I experience it from a golfer's point of view.
Interesting. So what do you see first? What is it that you see?
Well, of course, it's like anybody else. You see how the clubhouse is laid out and how convenient it is and how welcoming it is and the service. And if you feel welcome, if you feel like, hey, this is kind of a cool place, you know, I like this. Or if this is a bargain golf course, how are they setting it up so that it works? And do I really want to play here? That sort of thing. And then when you get on the golf course, you see how the driving range, if there is a driving range, how it's laid out, how convenient it is, how the carts are laid out. I mean, you know, you think about it as a golfer would, but you're also thinking about it, you know, how it's designed, how it's laid out, what's the planning, what's the programming. And then you stand on the first tee and you say, yeah, this looks pretty cool. Or, I don't know about this. I'm extremely critical when I get professional. So, and if I'm playing, I have to say I do get very critical about golf courses.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? What do you? So let's go now that you've seen the clubhouse, now that you've seen the driving range. Now we're stepping up to the first tee, and you're looking down the fairway to a par four, and you know you can see the flag from where you are. Strategically, what do you look at?
Well, I mean, for me personally, I try to hit the ball left to right, so I'm trying to think, can I get to where I want to be? Does it make sense to do that, or does this hole designed so that it makes any difference where you are in the fairway? What if I miss? Where am I going to be? Because I'm like a 10 handicap, so I can hit it down the middle, and I can also hit it 150 feet to the right or left, and I don't know which way it's going. So, I always say I'm the ideal architect because I play every man's game. You know, I'm not Jack Nicklaus. I don't hit it in the same spot every time and know that I'm going to have a 7-iron on my next shot. So, you know, I look at it from that point of view, like, oh, God. If I'm feeling confident, I'm looking in the middle of the fairway. If I'm not, I'm thinking, okay, where is this ball going? You know, so I look at everything. And I also look at the strategy and how well kept it's, you know, how well maintained it is. And on the style. I mean, there's a lot of style to bunker shapes, bunker locations, elevation changes, how much dirt they moved, all kinds of stuff. Is this a natural golf course or is it contrived? You know, all that stuff. So I'm saying 100 thoughts are going through my head at once. And
interesting.
And if any golfer knows, you got 100 thoughts in your head when you're swinging the club, you're not going to get anywhere. So I try to block it out.
Wow. That's got to be tough.
It's tough. It's like taking a camera on the golf course. Are you going to photograph it or are you going to play it? Come on. You know, you got to do one of the two. So I like to play it and then sort of make judgments afterwards, you know, like think about it.
Can you remember what you...
I remember every shot, every hole, yeah.
Do you?
On every golf course.
And you remember the layout. You remember details.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you like playing unfamiliar courses?
Yeah, I do.
Is it too much work for you?
No, I do. I do very much. I mean, and I like to play my friends' designs and layouts because I have a lot more respect.
Because you get free golf.
Well, that's part of it, yeah. And they're always, you know, it's always in beautiful places. But unfortunately, I judge quite a bit, you know, and I'll go through and I go, you know, this isn't worth the money, or, wow, this is great. I want to go back and play this because there's a lot to learn. There's a lot of fun. You know, I can make a putt. I made a birdie, you know, or whatever. But I am a very extremely critical person. And some people, I mean, I've learned to keep it to myself. Because, you know, nobody wants to hear somebody whining about a golf course or always praising, you know, unless you really push me for it, you know. So I'll keep my mouth shut.
You just mentioned, is it worth the money? Extrapolate on that for me. What does that mean? Because I've played courses like, you know, it's not worth $5 a hole, you know, or $5
exactly.
A shot.
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean to you? Is it worth it to play a golf course for what you pay?
Well,
to
if
play?
You're paying $160 and you can have just as good of experience, you know, at home on your Muni or whatever for, you know, 1/10 that price, you think, well, this is a kind of a ripoff, you know, and if there's a lot of gimmicks, especially on a golf course where an architect has tried to contrive it and make something that isn't there happen. Yeah, I just feel like, well, you know, I'm getting kind of ripped off. You know?
Does that frustrate you, gimmicks in design?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Describe a gimmick. What you mean by that?
Oh, gosh. Things like hidden lakes, you know, where they didn't design it well so that you can see the hazards. Greens that are, you know, like four tiers and then you can end up four putting. That really drives me nuts, you know, stuff like that.
Undulated greens are okay.
Undulating greens are okay.
Multiple tier?
Yeah, they're okay.
To a certain extent. Yeah. 3-4 tier.
Well, whatever. I mean, you know, if it's, you know, it depends on the type of hole, too. I mean, if it's a nothing hole and then all of a sudden there's three tiers in a green, that's pretty contrived and it doesn't make any sense. But if it's a nice rolling golf course and it's a big green and you're hitting like a, you know, your shot in is a precise shot and you've got to hit to a precise part of the green, that makes sense. But, you know, in general, you know, rolling huge greens for the sake of rolling huge greens doesn't do much for me.
We played together last week is when we met, and we were in the cart together. And you said something that I found really interesting and fascinating is that you talked about these mounds that, not large mounds, you know, and a course that's not necessarily flat, but they hide your target.
Right. That subtly hide your target.
That you're trying to get away from doing that in your design.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, these are really subtle mounds that hide the front part of the green or one quarter of the green. And that is, you know, there's a design element to that. Mm-hmm. And because if you hit a short shot, it'll kick your ball left or right or kick it over the green or whatever. And it'll hide where the pin is, so you kind of don't know what's going on. I kind of like to see the ball hit the green if you're there. You know, if you have the opportunity to hit a good shot. And it just, those little things, you know, to me, of course, I'm a huge critic, as you're getting to know. those things kind of bother me. But more so than that are these artificial mounds you see everywhere. And I'll tell you where that came from. The American Society of Golf Course Architects have an annual visit together. And there's like 100 of us. And we get together every year. We go somewhere different. And we learn new courses. Or we go to Scotland. We go to Ireland, wherever. And in the late 60s, early 70s, I don't know when it was, we all went to Scotland. This is before I was a member, but I've talked to a lot of guys, and they played Prestwick, and they played Troon, and they played a lot of places where there were railroad ties. There were all kinds of real messy bunkers and lots of mounting and all kinds of stuff, which is all natural. It wasn't built. The railroad ties were there to shore up bunkers. They weren't built to produce the bunkers, you know, sort of stuff like that. Lo and behold, we came back, and the next few generations of golf courses had all this stuff going on, and these huge mounds that kind of go roly-poly. And I think golfers know what I'm talking about, where fairways are separated by these huge mounds. That's a nice separation at times, but also it's aggravating if you miss the fairway and it goes out, you know, you don't know where it goes. You don't know whether to yell four or not because you can't see anybody. You know, and it's a real aggravating, and for the guys who are mowing grass, you know. I mean, it's nice to have a nice elevation change and get a nice, you know, present the hole if it's a dog leg right, and you can, you know, kind of elevate it like a freeway. That's kind of a neat thing to do. But when you have these artificial, in my opinion, gimmicky, and they're all contrived, you know, I'm not for that sort of thing.
Have there been other meetings where you think that design elements came out of some of these meetings that everyone, like, all of a sudden it became very cool for everyone, or everyone noticed that, oh my gosh, we all have the same new feature that we just discussed?
Yeah, well, I think that was kind of a big, that changed a lot of things. And then the next big thing that happened was, Jack Nicklaus got involved, and, you know, the greatest golfer up to that point. And he started to design golf courses, and as a result, he charged a lot of money. I don't know if I want to say this, but you know,
we're not going to ask the specifics. But
you might want to cut this out, but
might not.
He charged a lot of money, and all of a sudden, golf course architects were not the paupers anymore that became the princes, because they could automatically charge double what they were charging, but still charge incredibly lower than what Jack Nicklaus was getting. So everybody got elevated, and then the title of golf course architect became kind of like a, I don't know, royalty or something like that, and where we go now, we're like revered, you know.
So it's not as it wasn't as glamorous when you started in the business as it is
not
now.
Not really, and it's much more glamorous now, especially overseas. People think you're these gods, you know, and you know. Although I know I am a god. No, actually, it is very interesting because to me, it's what I love to do, and it's a job, and I love doing it. But to have people treat you like, you know, you're different than everybody else is kind of strange, you know. I mean, I was an athlete; it might be different, but.
But you're an architect.
I'm an architect.
And you could have been an architect of buildings, and you could have been a landscape architect.
And
you kind of flushed that out a little bit.
And I wouldn't expect to walk around and have people ask my autograph and stuff like that, which is pretty kind of weird, you know.
And that
happens?
In fact,
we had a job in China where we had a parade of banners and floats and everything. It was like a mile long coming into a town in northern China.
Yeah. Because you arrived?
Yeah, because we arrived. Oh, my God, it was wonderful. Thing happening. So, yeah, it's very interesting. We're looking out the door.
Wow.
We're looking out the window of the limousines, so and we're going, oh, who's in town? What's this all about? You know, oh, no, this is for you, Robinson. You know, and I go, oh, really? You know, so you kind of sit back and go, what the heck's going on here? And then you put in perspective, you know, what it is. You know, I mean, golf is internationally, it's in a lot of places, a very big deal.
Should golf pros be golf course designers?
Well, I mean,
because you say it obviously changed your industry in many ways, financially as well as status wise. But,
yeah.
You know, are they designing for golf pros? Are they designing for golfers? Or are they designing for the owners?
Well, you have to look at it from this standpoint. When somebody gets into the industry, into the design industry from another industry, and they don't have any background in it.
In architecture?
Well, let's take a typical pro. He's won a U.S. Open or whatever. Now he's a golf course architect. It doesn't happen like that. It's like, you know, you don't eat a good meal and then go back and say, I can design the kitchen now. because I know what the meal tastes like. You know, it doesn't work like that. It's like, you know, it's taken me 35 years to get to where I am. I'm learning something new every day. You don't just say, I'm a golf course architect. What these guys do is they have architects like me or somebody else that they work with, and they, you know, they'll contribute what they can. But
so they're licensing their name.
Yeah, it's mostly licensing their name. Now, there are some, that's not true with everybody. I mean, you know, there's Mark McCumber, John Fote, guys like that who are members of our society are actually bona fide golf course architects. And Jack Nicklaus, too. They're bona fide golf course architects, sit there and do the analysis plan, do the environmental impact statement, do all the drawings, understand what they're doing, do a budget, you know, work with a contractor, know how to do all that stuff. They know what they're doing. But I wouldn't say that's true with 99% of them. A lot of them come out and they, you know, if they're listening to this, they know I'm right. You know, that they can wave their hands and say, well, that bunker's too high or whatever. But until we get to that point, you know, we're talking months and months, even years of planning and drawing and going through all kinds of processes to get there. So, I mean, there's a lot to it.
Interesting.
And I mean, I think Tiger Woods is learning that now.
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, his name has come up as well.
And I mean, to have a golf course designed by Tiger Woods, come on, that's the end of all world. That's the greatest thing in the world. But I think Tiger's learning now that there's more to it than just saying, I'm a golf course architect. He's got, and I know who his architects are, and I, you know, he hasn't come out in public, he said who they are, but they're really good people, and he'll have great golf courses. But, you know, as far as him calling himself an architect, you know, let's be realistic about it. You know?
Right. It's like, this is my architecture firm
that
my name is on.
Yes.
And I have great people working for me because I can. Because he probably commands top dollar. Right out the gate, he can probably command a lot of money for that.
Well, his first project, I don't know how many he's done. I think he's done, maybe he's into his third. I don't know. I don't know at this stage. But his first one in Dubai, his fee was $26 million.
And is that an outrageous sum of money? I mean, I don't know, because I don't know what a golf course architect charges since Jack Nicklaus started.
No, it's way out of our league. And the big fear was like, well, if he charges what we all charge, then why would anybody hire anybody but him? Because his name means so much, you know. But yeah, he gets top dollar.
And how much of it is ownership ego that gets involved in who they hire, you know, or is it a marketing thing?
I think it's mostly marketing. There must be some guys who hire big names because they want to rub elbows. So I don't know that for a fact.
Well, like there's Trump, who's now building courses. I mean, I don't know who he's using to design his courses, but I know he wants to have his name first on anything he does.
So I don't think he'd ever... I couldn't tell you who he hires because I don't know. But I guess when somebody has an ego, and I don't know Donald Trump, but if you're an ego and you don't want to have somebody else's name associated with your project, you hire somebody that... you know, you wouldn't know. But I tell you what, everybody in the American Society of Golf Course Architects are excellent architects. So it's not like, you know, just because you don't know them doesn't mean it's going to be a great golf course. So.
And you like looking at other people's work.
Absolutely, yeah. We did a project in Bali, and it was between me and another architect who is a very well-known international name at the time. This is like 20 years ago. And my approach was, you know, it's a beautiful site in Bali, which is a unique place in the world. It's one of the most beautiful, serene, peaceful, wonderful places you'll ever go. If you ever get a chance, you should go. And it was a beautiful site. And I said, you know, if you hire so-and-so, this will be a so-and-so golf course. And you can play a so-and-so golf course in Florida. You can play it in New York. You can play it in Mexico. You can play it anywhere. But if you hire somebody that no one knows, this becomes the Bali Golf and Country Club. It doesn't become a da-da-da-da. This becomes a unique place because it is a unique, you know, whatever. It's a unique golf course with no name on it. So it's your golf course for this specific place. And that's, you know, on that pitch, that's how I got the job. And I actually meant it. I mean, it was, you know, of course I wanted the job, but I mean, that was true, and it still is in many ways.
But if you're trying to create a destination resort,
right,
and anywhere in the world these days, does it enhance your marketability if Trent Jones' name is on it?
Well, what happens with those kind of names, there's like maybe half a dozen that you recognize. You have instant credibility, and people will say, oh, well, you know, it's a good place to go because it's got Tom Fazio's name on it.
Right.
But the important thing in resorts now is not getting the people there, it's keeping them there.
And how do they do that?
Well, I mean, if you play the golf course and it's a stinker, you know, it's too hard or you don't like it, then, you know, it's like, well, that was cool, but I don't want to stay here. But if the course is designed well and it's, you know, it's really neat and there's all kinds of interesting things about it that you didn't really see the first time, second time, I want to play it again. It doesn't matter who designed it, you know. And the other part of that, too, is if
the you want to stay there because, like, the resort, the amenities beyond the golf course.
Yeah.
Is the kind of things like this is beautiful.
But yeah. The other thing, too, is more importantly than the design is the maintenance of the golf course.
Mm.
If the greens are crappy, but it's a big-name architect, doesn't matter who designed it. If it's no fun to play, then why, you know, you're not going to pay the $200 or $150 or whatever that is. But if you get out there, it's well-designed, well-constructed, it's got a good program, good business plan, good people, and it's in good condition, you're treated well, it's worth every penny. It really is. I mean, that's why it's so critical that when you design a or when you build or develop a golf course, it's not just the architect. There's six different parts of a building of a golf course.
Go ahead.
Well, there's, you know, there's the site, of course, where it is, where it's located. And then there's the design, which is the architect. But then there's also who builds it and how well they built it, because there's a huge discrepancy in construction. I mean, experience is everything in construction. And then there's the maintenance of the golf course. If the greens are in good shape, that's everything. The design doesn't mean anything if the greens are in crappy shape.
You know? Right.
I mean, you know that's true.
Because that's what people are going to walk away. I mean, I've talked to many people about, there's a guy I have every year now on the show who his goal is to play the top 100 courses. So he goes around the world playing these courses. And it sounds to me like when he's reviewing a course, he'll talk about the beauty around it. He won't necessarily talk about the playability, because it's already been ranked in the top 100. But he talks about, oh, it's a beautiful course. Oh, the surroundings are beautiful.
Yeah.
So the things you walk away with, the greens were crappy and it was a beautiful place. You know, I mean, those are the things that I think for the average golfer that's going to jump out.
Right, exactly. Exactly true. And then the other two parts of that were the clubhouse. You know, the clubhouse got to be nice.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be nice. I mean, you can play, where is it? In Ireland, there's many clubhouses that are, you know, size of my garage, really, and it doesn't matter. But that's not true in every place, and Americans expect a good clubhouse. The sixth part of this equation is really, I like to call them owner management operational standpoint.
Mm.
You've got to have that in place. You've got to have that working, or it's just bad for the experience, you know. But getting back to the point about if you have a lousy time playing golf, and it's the golf course's, you know, reflection of the golf course, lousy greens, blind. You know, blind bunkers, blind hazards, and, you know, unfair shots. It doesn't matter who designed it. You're not going to want to play it again. You know,
right.
You know, you gotta. I don't know. There's some purists out there that might be like that, masochists. But my feeling is, if my wife likes to play this golf course, it's a good golf course, because, you know. I mean, seriously, it gets to that point, you know.
Do you take your wife out after you're finished with the project or in the middle of a project?
She's there at the opening, and you know, she's. She's not a real good golfer, but she knows.
But that's important,
likes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's very important, because how many of us are really good golfers? We just want to play. We want a chance to play our game, and play it fairly and enjoy it.
Yeah. So
I mean,
you
golf, the game of golf is hard enough as it is. Why make it any harder?
Wait, that's an interesting thing. Are golf courses? Are we running out of room? Are there too many golf courses? Are there places where they just can't build golf courses
Well,
anymore?
It's certainly a supply and demand issue. I mean, what was it, 10, 15 years ago when the NGF came out and said, we're going to have to open up one golf course a day for the next how many years to meet the demand? Well, we've reached it, and we're to the point now, especially in this economy, where there aren't many new courses being built. In fact, there are quite a few golf courses that are going under and being turned into housing developments or parks or whatever, because they don't make any sense. They don't make any money. But that's not true in every country, and it's a supply and demand issue. In fact,
where are you doing most of your work?
Well,
now?
We're doing it everywhere. I mean, we're doing it in China, Korea. I have a project in Morocco. There's the Eastern Bloc that's going to start up. We have a job in Pakistan. And finding, you know, there's resort properties all over that have enough land to put a golf course that don't have golf courses. You know, I'm thinking of, like, the coast of Turkey. It's like the 17-mile drive of Pebble Beach, the whole place. And it has numerous hotels, many, many acres of land, but no golf. And it's a perfect place to bring, you know, the people from Germany and England and France and Spain who want to go to that part of Europe or the Eastern Europe and stay for a week on the coast and also play golf. But they haven't introduced the game there yet. Turkey's one of the few places where there isn't much golf. So I actually, I would love to work there because it's absolutely beautiful there.
Yeah, yeah. What to you would be a great opportunity? Is there something coming up maybe that you would really love to work on a project that is the future of where golf courses are headed?
I've got a project coming up that's, I don't know if it's actually the future of golf, but it's something that's close to my heart, and it's in this, I can't reveal where it is.
It's okay.
Me, obviously.
Which country?
It's in the United States. It's okay. In the central United States, and it's,
we'll keep it.
It's an old, strip mine that has been, it was used for coal excavation in the 50s. Where they stripped out the top 25 feet of the site, and it's 10,000 acres. And I don't know if anybody realizes how big 10,000 acres is. It is gigantic.
It's okay, so a normal golf course is
100 to 150 to 200 acres.
Okay, so 10,000 acres.
10,000 acres, like take your town and multiply it by five. It's as far as you can see in all directions, you know.
Okay.
And anyway, this place has, it's had 150 lakes on it, and it's absolutely beautiful. It rolls, rolling topography, and when they, the power company who extracted the coal went back and revegetated it in the 50s with about 10 feet, of, not 10 feet, but about 5 feet of topsoil and replanted it with, you know, blues, ryes, and fescues, which is the perfect golf mix. So you've got a golf course that's sitting there on 10,000 acres. And it's also used, excuse me, as a wildlife preserve right now. It's a very interesting place. And without getting too involved with that, it's a type of place where you want to talk about environmentally correct things to do. We could, with these animals and with the lakes, and if you build 18 greens and just started mowing, you'd have a fabulous golf course out there because the holes are there. It's just a matter of, you don't move any dirt, you just build greens. I mean, you know, you can push up greens, and but you got to have nice greens because, like I said earlier, if the greens aren't nice, you're not going
to
like it.
Yeah, but if you're not going to have to maintain anything but the greens,
exactly.
Your costs are going to be...
Exactly. Exactly, that's my whole point. And so all your efforts in the greens, you don't even have any irrigation in the fairways for this project because the rainfall is such that it'll be green most of the year round, and you just take care of it. When the drought goes, it's like playing the British Open. I mean, it's very much like that. And we've even experimented with ideas about, you know, how the sheep used to mow the fairways. And you do that with an electric fence and with the collars and all that. I mean, we would try that. It hasn't actually been done, but it's a pretty cool idea because that's how St. Andrews started, as you know.
Right, right.
Because the sheep would take care of the fairways. They would actually build the bunkers, and the rabbits were eating the little fescues on the greens, and that's how that... And we're talking, in the 1400s. So this is 600... Is that right? 600, 700
So it's time for it to come back. It would be a great project.
I don't know if every golf course could come back like this. Kind of neat idea, but the point being that golf is golf. You know, it's hitting the ball from one point to another. And who's to say that, you know, that's the way golf began? Why can't we do it again? Yeah. Anyway, it's a low budget, but a fabulous place. And the low budget transforms to, a lot of people can play it. And I think it'll have huge publicity because this is a very big deal in this part of the world.
It'd be awesome. Well, good luck on that one.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that golf is just too hard.
For
the average golfer.
It's a hard game.
Is there too much emphasis and even from your perspective, is there too much emphasis on par for golfers?
I know where you're leading with this one.
Yes
and no. I mean, par is, it's like your handicap. It's what you could shoot, not necessarily what you're going to shoot. You know what I mean?
Tell me the story.
Well, we did a project in Hawaii, and it's in the sand dunes of Maui, which nobody even realized there were sand dunes in Maui, but it's where Maui is kind of like an isthmus, and the middle is where all this sand ended up, and it's in the Kiabi trees, and so this fellow wanted to build a housing complex there. But in this housing complex, there had to be a big flood basin to get all the rainfall and everything in there. And he came to me and said, "Well, what do you think? Maybe could we put a golf course? Would that work? You know?" And I looked at it, and he had had an engineer to the plant, and it was just massacred. Everything was like, you know, it's just, you know, like an engineer would do. And I said, "You know, actually, you have everything you need here with these sand dunes. If you just connected one or two." And then you have these big basins where you can hold the water at the same time you put the golf in. Because we all know it doesn't rain in Hawaii. There's never going to be any rain anyway. It's just a precaution. One is every 100 years. So anyway, long story short, he allowed me to do the golf course, and it became like a links course because it's in the sand dunes. Hmm. And although it's a different type of grass, different kind of humidity, you can't really have a true links course in Hawaii. But it was so much like Ireland that it was a kind of, it was uncanny in a way. And I said, you know, this golf course is kind of quirky because there's some holes that are between par threes and par fours and between par fours and par fives. I said, you know what we ought to do here? We should not have par, and we shouldn't even have hole numbers. We should just have name the hole, like, you know, Dunes Hole or Mount Haleakala Hole or whatever, and don't even tell anybody the
lake. With arrows pointing to the next one.
And just say, well, there's, you know, most of the holes are, you can see. And the golfer's going to get up there and go, well, what do we do? You know, should I take a driver? I mean, every hole is supposed to take a driver unless it's a par three. And that would be the point. It's like, you got to think your way around it. We'd look at it and go, should I hit a four iron? And the other thing was, is that there should be a rule on this golf course that you don't play metal play, you only play match play. You can't, of course, you can't do that. I mean, people want to play for a score. And they also want to know how much over par they are, so it never really happened. But the concept and the theory is sound because you play match play, you're playing against your partner, you're playing the golf course. You're not playing for a score. And that, to me, is what golf's all about.
Yeah, isn't that, you were telling me, I mean, that's how golf really started. It's all match play.
Yeah, well, and any golfer who knows, when they play by themselves, it is really...
U.S. Open, that final day, wasn't that match play?
That was match play.
There you go.
Well...
Those
yeah.
two guys.
Yeah, it turned out to be match play.
Yeah.
But anybody who plays golf and they play by themselves, they know that it's a spiritual experience. It really is. It's to me, that's the way it is. And if you can take away all the numbers and stuff like that and just enjoy it and just play it. And if you get an 11 on a hole and your partner gets a 12, or he gets, let's say you get 11, he gets a 10, you only lost by 1 point.
Right.
You know, you're not like seven strokes over par. You only lost by one. The next hole, you could be even. So... to me, that's like pure golf, and I wanted to do that. Of course, you know, being in a resort, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a neat idea.
It's a neat idea. It's a neat idea. Is the health of the industry in good shape?
Yeah, I think it'll always be in good shape. The growth is still happening. Kids and women are getting into it a little bit more. And I think Tiger has certainly had a big to do with that, and I think this U.S. Open didn't hurt any either, because you see, you know, Rocco Mediate out there, who is every man.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, he had a swing. I think my swing might even be better than his. Of course, he gets better results, but everybody can look at his swing and say, "I can swing like that. I can play with Tiger Woods." Yeah. You know, it's like it was so neat to see that.
Yeah.
And he's such a great guy.
Well, and the fact that they were so lucky that, it, you know, because of the West Coast, they were able to do it in prime time.
Yeah.
So more people got to see it. And then the fact that 3 days in a row, it went down to the absolute last.
Yeah, wasn't that amazing?
The tension was palpable, obviously. I mean, my stomach was in knots watching this. And the fact that, you know, unlike the time when Ben Hogan was playing, if you weren't there, you had to read about it. You don't know. But we had a front seat for every single shot.
Well, that was a thing. I think... I watch it because I say, I'm watching history. Right. I know that this is going to be historic. Because
we're going to be able to talk about this for a long time.
Yeah, well, first of all, I hoped that Tiger was going to be in the end because that makes it more interesting. But when Rocco tied him, you know that, and Tiger's limping around, you know, this is one of the greatest sports stories of all time. It's not only golf, it's just, this is great. I mean, my daughter called me from Denver, who does not play golf. She said, Dad, everybody is... You know, hunkered around. This is in her office. Everybody's hunkered around our TV set watching the U.S. Open. What is going on, you know? And I said, isn't that amazing? Isn't it great? And it brought tears to a lot of people's eyes. You know, it really did. Because it was just so dramatic.
So dramatic. It was great.
And you walk away with the feeling, I want to go out there and play now, you know? So it was great.
So hopefully people will.
Yeah, you couldn't write a better script. You could not write a better script.
No. Robin Nelson, thank you very much for giving this time. It was a really interesting conversation. Thanks.
Well, thanks. I'd like to do it again. There's a lot of time. Like I said earlier, there's a lot of stuff about golf course architecture we could cover.
So what do you think? Should he come back or not? Kudos to those of you who have been keeping an eye on the Golf Smarter blog for upcoming interviews. I've received many questions for upcoming conversation with Timothy Winey. He's the designer of the Torpedo Putter. Frankly, I really like having your questions on hand during the interview because you always seem to add a fresh perspective in the discussion. It's just great to know that those questions are there. Check out all the other topics we'll be covering in the next few weeks. You do realize that we are providing golf podcast content every day of the week now, right? Golf Smarter, Golf Smarter Tips, and Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf all cover different aspects of golf improvement and education, and each requires their own free subscriptions. Go to iTunes and subscribe to all three today. Of course, you can go to golfsmarter.com and get the links right directly to iTunes so it's easier to find it. But we really encourage you to not only subscribe to each of the shows, but write a review for each of the shows separately, so that other people who are looking for golf content know what you think of the show. Andy Newmarch wrote in to say that he's an avid listener in the UK and wants everyone to know about his website service called The Top 100 Golf Courses in the World. Right now, they feature about 1,700 worldwide courses on the site, and their goal is to get it to about 5,000 courses, top courses in the world. Now, the cool part of these rankings is that it's provided by you. Unlike all the other publications that rank courses, their content is provided by your reviews and recommendations. Andy is looking to get some American golfers to help write reviews about more courses in the United States. So I advise you, check them out. It's really a cool site. I enjoyed it. They are at www.top100golfcourses.co.uk. Today's closing quote is brought to you by caddytips.com. Receive professional written advice on how to play many of the courses in the United States, Scotland, and Ireland. You download, print, and then play better when you're armed with the info from the pros at caddytips.com. As a Golf Smarter listener, you get 50% all of your downloads. So check it out. Come on, go to caddytips.com/golfsmarter for all the information. You're going to have information on how to beat every course as if you have a caddy with you. caddytips.com/golfsmarter. Another longtime listener, Chris Coughlin of Monahawkin, New Jersey, wrote in to say that he loved the episode featuring Sorta Golf Commissioner Don Glenn. Now, I knew that episode would be controversial, but I didn't realize how much. Look, I'm not necessarily taking sides with any interview. I just want to find the stories you may not have heard about. It's up to you to decide whether the guy is legit or not. Clearly, this show touched a chord with a lot of you. In both directions. Well, anyway, Chris says that he's listened to Sorta Golf at least 4 times already and has been playing his own concept of it for years without knowing it had an official name. Today, he provides us with his own Sorta Golf quote. And again, don't shoot me, I'm only the messenger here. Here's what Chris has to say. You should count every shot you play, but you don't have to play every shot you hit. Next week, Target-Oriented Golf with Colin Cromack. If you have any quotes, comments, suggestions, or questions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Hi, I'm Jeff Mangum, putting instructor and founder of theputtingzone.com, inviting you to join me each week on the Golf Smarter Tips podcast. I'll give you short tips, drills, and exercises on how to use your brain to putt your best ever. So before you head out to the links each weekend, make sure you download the Friday version of Golf Smarter Tips, free on iTunes or at golfsmartertips.com. Together we can learn how to roll 'em and hole 'em.